Hey, Whiskey Ringers, welcome to a brand new intro. First off, there are still a few bottles of our barrel, single barrel rye, finished in Armagnac casks, picked in partnership with This Is My Bourbon podcast. Check out the show notes for links to purchase. Second, I am thrilled to announce that I've joined the Bar Cart Co-op. This group of podcasts and shows has a show or multiple for everyone. I'll talk more about them in the mid-roll. Finally, there are still two $25 spots available on Patreon. These are the last two spots that will ever be open on that tier, so if you've been putting it off, grab your spot today. There are also spots available at the $15 a month level if you want to support, but can't quite commit to that $25 tier just yet. There's a spot in supporting for everyone's budget, and I truly thank you all for making this podcast possible. Hey, folks, welcome to a special semi-update, semi-brand new episode with the Whiskey Ring Podcast. Today, I'm bringing back on Nora and Adam from Lost Lantern, and I am thrilled to have them back on. So you may have remembered them from an earlier episode when they were kind of getting off the ground and as one of the real first true independent bottlers that are making names for themselves here. But there's been a lot that's happened since then. So I'll throw it over to Nora and Adam to reintroduce themselves and tell us what's new.
Awesome. Well, first, thank you so much for having us. This is fun to be back on. We really enjoyed our last conversation, so I've been looking forward to this.
Yeah, absolutely. It's fun to be back.
Yeah. So I'm Nora.
And Adam.
And we're the co-founders of Lost Lantern Whiskey. We're an independent bottler of American whiskey. So for us, that means buying whiskey from distilleries all over the country, highlighting specific distilleries through either a unique single cask or a small blend of barrels, which we call our single distillery series, or blending multiple whiskeys or whiskey from multiple distilleries together to create something entirely new and show the interesting things that we're seeing in the American whiskey market. And with full transparency on where it comes from. So the distillery names are on the front of the label, the back of the label. You shouldn't be able to miss the fact that we're curating and blending. We're not the distillers.
Awesome. And I should note two things. The first one being that you mentioned that you've done some, you know, multi-barrel blends of the same distillery, one of which you beat the distillery at their own game.
Yes.
The second thing I want to mention is in support of what you're saying about the transparency, that I was recently fortunate to visit you up in Vermont and see their production and see the barrels that you guys have sitting around, let's say, for lack of a better term, waiting to bottle or blend. And yeah, there's no secrets. It's all right there. A lot of them you can even see from the tasting room. So it's not, there really is nothing secret. It's freakly about skill, the skill of picking the barrels, I should say, and the skill of knowing when to put them out as a single and when to blend them. So with that, I'd like to kind of set the stage. So right now we're talking about your spring 2024 collection, which is of six distilleries plus a blend specific to this release called Far Flung Rye. And so tell us a little more about this spring release, because I know it's your theming for the first time.
Yes. So this year we're doing pretty strict themes with all of our releases. And for the spring collection, it's actually our first ever regional collection where all the whiskeys come from one part of the country. We're calling it the Midwest Collection because it showcases whiskeys from all across the Midwest, which we actually think of as a real rising star of American whiskey that is not talked about nearly as much as it should be. There's great whiskey coming from all corners of that region, from Indiana and Ohio over to Iowa and the upper Midwest as well. And we really wanted to showcase some of the places that we've fallen in love with out there.
Awesome. And there are, you know, a couple that are familiar to me, as we were saying before recording, we've had on Middle West and Cedar Ridge. Both have been guests on the Whiskering podcast. I have tried Few Spirits and Starlight before, as well as Wollersheim Distillery. I don't think I had heard of Tom's Foolery before this. So that one's completely new to me. Starlight, it's been a few years. So, you know, and we've got some really exciting things too. We got bourbons. We have a couple of ryes, the malted wheat whiskey from Cedar Ridge. So we won't taste them all on air, but we want to give you a little highlight, and there will be notes, and we'll have a full lineup available when this episode comes out. So because I think you can people start as of like at, literally as of today, as of recording, can people start ordering them already?
Not until March 27th.
March 27th. Okay. So so the chances are by the time this comes out, which should be in, you know, a week or so, then people will be able to order. If not, that link will be in there anyway, just ready to go.
Cool.
Great. So I'll let you lead. Where should we start?
Yep. The Sparkling Rye first. So the flagship of the collection is Sparkling Rye, which is our first ever blend of straight ryes from multiple distilleries. This is a follow-up to a release we did last year called Far-Flung Bourbon, which was a blend of bourbons from Nevada, Ohio, Colorado, and Texas. So that was not focused on one particular region of the country, but this one is. All the ryes in this come from the Midwest. It's a blend of rye from Starlight in Indiana, Tom's Foolery in Middle West in Ohio, Wollersheim in Wisconsin, and Cedar Ridge in Iowa, which are all also represented as single casks in the collection. And for us, this shows why we're so excited about Midwestern whiskey. And we think that the flavors come together in this in a way that shows that the region does have some continuity and regional flavor and character, which, Nora, what would you say are the traits that we usually see in Midwest whiskey?
It's usually lighter and more delicate than what we're used to. It also has, I don't like influencing, but it's applicable. They all have a creaminess to their palate that we don't see necessarily from warmer climates. And what is the last one? I'm blanking on the last.
Like relative like balance. No.
That's like the delicacy. I think it's more grain forward or cereally than we necessarily get elsewhere, because it's the bread basket. So there are a lot of places that are sourcing grain from local climates. So you see that as well, but generally less oak influence as well, because it's a cooler climate.
Right. I was thinking of that as you were listening off the distilleries, as we were looking at a couple of the ones that are represented here, that the Midwest, like you said, it's a bread basket. It's where so much of our grain comes from, be it corn, rye, wheat. And yes, there are local producers in many states of those, but there's something about the Midwest whiskey culture that has come off to me as just the farmers are so much closer to their grain, mm-hmm. that they want to showcase that grain. And they want to make sure you know that if it's, you know, if it's Middle West, that they're getting rye from, if they can, from Ohio. If they're in Cedar Ridge, if they can get corn from Iowa, which they should be able to get corn from Iowa, they've got enough of that. You know, they don't want to hide the grain. They want it to be mature and ready to drink. They don't want it to be necessarily White Dog, but they want it to be not hidden behind so much of an oak cask influence, which goes to what you also said, which, you know, cooler climate, less aging. These also, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, these tend to be on the what some people would consider the younger side, like closer to 4 to 6 years, maybe.
Ish. Yeah, 4 to 6, with the exception of the Tom's Foolery, which is 9 years old. Which is interesting from our perspective as independent bottlers working all around the country. Whereas I would say that for us, that's pretty much in our average. It's like older than what you usually see from Texas or the really hot climates. But definitely younger than you can sometimes see from Kentucky.
When we started releasing whiskey in 2020, the average that we were looking at was more like 4 years. And we've seen that move up to 6 years being more common for places. And that makes sense, because as the distilleries age, they have older whiskey. But for us, it's not notably younger than what we normally see from places.
And the Far-Flung Rye, the component is a 4-year age statement, and the components in it range from 4 to 9 years.
Yeah. So we should say this is at a brisk 60.8% ABV, so 121.6 proof. For the first drink of the day, it's actually quite drinkable, I should say. I didn't warm myself up before this, and I probably should have. But it's not blowing my palate at all. It has a lot of delicateness. I'm getting candy. No, sweet. Oh, like if you took a rye grain and candied it, or if you made a, I don't know if you could do popcorn out of a rye, but you know, something like that, where it's
kettle corn, but made from rye.
Yeah. It's one of those things where you got to take the imaginative leap with your mind to kind of get to that note, but that's kind of what I'm getting. It does have the herbaceousness that you would expect, enough so that you can know it's a rye, which I appreciate. I like knowing what spirit I'm drinking. But no, this is very balanced. Drinks, I would argue, below proof, maybe closer to like 110 or so. And very fragrant nose. Just flows out of the glass. So how many, as this is the blend for this theme, how many iterations did you kind of go through before landing on this particular one?
It took us about 3 months. It's one of the longer, granted we're blending right now and it's taking longer for our next upcoming blend. But 3 months, mostly because we had originally only planned on doing whiskey from 4 distilleries. We generally build these far-flung releases with the best of what we have currently in inventory. And this is even more restrictive because it was all Midwestern whiskey. And so we could get like 85% of the way there with what we had. And in the end, we decided to call in a barrel of malted rye from Cedar Ridge because we had done a single cask from that. We played with that with the other component parts and realized that that was what was missing from the blend. So you reached out to Murphy.
Yeah, like 4 days before Christmas last year. And was like, hey, what would it take to get a barrel of malted rye here like instantly? And he helped us make it happen. I think we got it in by the end of January and put the blend together. And it was exactly what the blend needed. And we were excited to have Cedar Ridge represented in the blend anyway, since it's one of our favorite distilleries in the country. So I'm glad to have it in there. But it did.
It kind of mellowed it out. It was a little spiky until we brought that in. And so that kind of, I think that was the thing that brought down the proof a little bit. But for us, like with blending, it takes however long it takes, for better or for worse. Sometimes we generally do at least 4 rounds, but every once in a while, one of the first prototype blends that we make, it comes back. We usually bring along our favorite 1 to 2 things from the previous flight and put it in the next flight. And we do as much blind. And then sometimes like, with Brooklyn Bakery, which is our Kings County single distillery blend that you were the primary blender on.
Blend number one went out.
Yeah. It kept going through flights, but it kept on being the one that we'd pick as our favorite. And so finally we just gave in and said, I don't think we can improve this. But it really, truly, if we don't think it's there, we won't put it out. So
I mean, sometimes you strike gold on day one. That the Brooklyn Bakery blend is excellent. I've gotten to try it twice now. Once at Whiskeys of the World and once up in Vermont. And I highly encourage people, especially fans of Kings County, but people who are just fans of a really strong vanilla pastry, baking spice. I mean, it's exactly what it sounds like in a bottle. And because it's a blend and not a single barrel, there are a couple more bottles available than may be normally available, especially
for getting low, but there's still some bottles.
So before we move on to the next one, I wanted to ask you about naming your blends. So in terms of, you know, naming products, I always go back to the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society model of things, where they've just got a panel of tasters and someone, they all taste and someone just throws out something that says, oh, Pleasantly Sublime, or a walk. I think one of the ones I have is maybe an Orkney Beekeeper's sandwich or something. You know, they can be very real and also just wackadoodle. So when you're looking at not only the Far Flung Rye, but I also got a chance to try the Smoke and Flame blends that you had recently, as well as a couple of the other single distillery blends. When you're thinking of those names, how do you go about deciding?
We want them to be evocative and to give you a sense of how we hope the whiskey, not just how it will taste, but how it will make you feel. And having just said that, which sounds very pretentious, we want a name that doesn't sound too pretentious. So something that is like 1 or 2 words for our single distillery, for our blends of whiskey from multiple distilleries, it'll usually be either a single word like flame and shadow, or like far-flung bourbon or far-flung rye. So just the word and then what it is. Where our single distillery series all have alliterative names like Brooklyn Bakery, Mountain Meadow,
Gentle Giant.
Yeah.
Which should tell you something about the whiskey, but also our Lost Lantern is alliterative. So we're continuing that tradition of alliteration, but also, yeah, trying to make it as evocative as possible so people have a sense of what the profile is going in.
Gotcha. And thank you. I said earlier, Flame and Smoke, it was Flame and Shadow. My apologies for that.
Intentionally so, because the word smoke scares some people. So we actually had extensive conversation about what we call it that still evokes that same kind of like swath of smoke without calling it smoke and scaring everyone away. So,
That was it's not part of this collection, but it is worth visiting just for a second. The smoke involved it's American smoke. So we're talking, you know, mesquite and different woods and such. So it's not the peat. So it gives you an opportunity to introduce people to this whole new swath of flavor profiles and distilleries that could be involved without ever tasting iodine, Band-Aids, any tar, you know, any of the things that some of us don't like in our whiskeys. Yeah.
So Flame is mesquite. Shadow is actually peat, but it's got American oak on it as well. Right. So it is a different profile. You're not getting the full iodine treatment for sure.
Right. Yeah, it's enjoyable. It's enjoyable if you're not a Lafroy person,
right? Yes. Which we are, but we also know that there is a whole range of people that aren't. So
fair enough. Fair. I like to say I can do most of Isla, but Lafroy I can even do Octomore's, oddly enough, because of the different peat type and the way that they handle it. But Octomore, yes. Lafroy, I had to put it in like the heavy, heavy sherry cask from a cartridge release a couple years ago. It's like PX for a year or something. It's the only Lafroy I've been able to drink.
His favorite. It's your favorite
Scotch. They're like big name Scotch
brand. Distillery,
It's not my favorite Scotch. Sorry, they're big name Scotch brand.
But
for the record,
your favorite Scotch that we can buy in the state of Vermont, probably.
Probably,
So, which is a limited choice.
All right. So, what shall we go to next?
You want to do the Wollersheim next?
Sure.
Yeah, sounds good. Let's do that.
Do that and then Starlight and then Tom's Foolery.
Sure. That sounds good. Are we doing the Starlight?
Oh, maybe. I don't know. We'll figure it out as we go. We'll make it work. So, but see, you need to tell. He's better at telling the story than I am. So I'll let you.
So Wollersheim is a new distillery partner for us with this series, but we've been keeping an eye on them for a while. We visited them for the first time in 2019, when we were touring the Midwest. It's our first Wisconsin distillery partner. And they are a family-owned winery and distillery with roots dating back to the 19th century. Has not been in the same family or even in continuous operation for that whole time, but some of the vines that were there were planted in the 1850s or 1860s by one of the fathers of California winemaking, who stopped in Wisconsin for a couple of years on his way west from Hungary to California. And they started distilling about 15 years ago, primarily to make brandy, which is very, very popular in Wisconsin. Wisconsin drinks more brandy than any other state by a huge margin. But it was a pretty quick jump from there, from making brandy with their grapes to making whiskey with Wisconsin grown grains. So this is a bourbon. 5 years old, cast strength as usual for most of our releases, and definitely exemplifies, we think, the more grain forward side of Midwestern whiskey, where you can smell the barrel, you can taste the barrel, but there's also the grain in out there too.
Absolutely. It's a bourbon, so you expect the corn to come out, but it is coming out. Doesn't taste like the burnt corn oil note that you can sometimes get with a quote unquote craft distillery. You don't get that at all. This one is hitting me a little hotter. It is at 65.6%.
This is our strongest whiskey in this collection for sure.
Yeah. I am admittedly feel like I'm a little out of practice with the higher proofs recently.
Because that's the other thing about Midwestern whiskey. That's the thing I forgot, is that it is generally lower proof. Because the cool climate, you're not getting the same level of water evaporation as you do in hotter climates. So you will see proof generally go up in most places, but it's way more gradual. So we haven't seen any hazmat releases, for example, from the Midwest. This is stronger by a good margin than the other ones that we have in the collection, because the cool climates just don't play with the hotter whiskey. So
sure. With Wallerstein, this is a good opportunity to re-ask a question that I asked in our initial interview, but I think is worth asking again, which is, you mentioned you go on these trips to different places. When you first started Lost Center, you went on a year and a half trip to just all around the country, visiting different distilleries.
Eight month road trip.
Yeah.
Then a month or two, a couple months of a break, then a few more visits. Then we went on a month long Midwest focus trip after that. And then COVID obviously shut down distillery visits for a good while, but did a month long trip through the South year and a half ago. And then even it's March 2024, and this year already I've been to distilleries in Kentucky, Tennessee, Arkansas, Colorado, Missouri, Kansas, and we'll add a few in New York in the next couple of weeks.
Nice. So
we keep busy. We only work with distilleries that we visited in person. We really want to see for ourselves how they're making whiskey, how the climate feels, get an understanding of what is driving these people to decide to make whiskey and make the choices that they make. So if we're going to go out and tell their story and get people excited about it, we want to make sure we understand for ourselves what they're doing.
Yeah.
So with let's take the case of Wallerstein. You've got to taste it, got to try it, visit them first 2019, you said?
Yeah.
So you've had a couple of years now to think about it, to maybe visit again, to taste different things from them. Perhaps using them as an example, what's a certain criteria that you need that says, okay, we are going to work with this distillery? You mentioned, of course, you need to see it yourself, but after you've seen it yourself and tasted the product, what differentiates a yes distillery, a no distillery, and maybe something in the middle that says maybe in a few years?
It's a very good question.
I think, so for us, it's always a combination of the whiskey, the people, and the story the whiskey tells. So all of those have to come together in a way that feels compelling to us. So it's whiskey has to be good. There's a baseline, but in some ways for us, that's table stakes. We also have to like the people and want to talk about them endlessly because that's what we do once we release from them and feel like they're also excited to be part of our program and it's a real partnership. And then we're also looking to have whiskey that tells us something about either the production methods that the distillery is using, the climate, or something else entirely that we don't know going into it. For this, it's about climate. It's about but it's also about the approach to buying local grains. What does Wisconsin bourbon taste like? To us, this is telling us what Wisconsin bourbon tastes like. It doesn't taste like Kentucky. It doesn't taste like New York. It doesn't taste like Iowa. And that's why, especially for this collection, we wanted them to be part of it, because especially like we're buying more for these themes actively. And so when we think about Midwestern whiskey, we were looking for whiskeys that exemplify the characteristics that we have seen explicitly. And this was the whiskey that we thought showed that more cereally grain forward style of whiskey that we see from across the Midwest. And this was a great example for us to put forward for that.
Yeah. And then on the more practical side, there are other pieces of when we're going to work with the distillery. Like they need to have a certain amount of mature whiskey. Like when we first visited Wallerstein in 2019, they had a few five-year-old casks, but they probably had like less than a dozen at that point. And they had a lot more that were 2 or 3 years old and they were nowhere near ready yet. And now 5 years later, they've had that much longer to build out their pipeline, let whiskey mature, have ramp up the amount that they're making and let it get to a certain age. And there's a certain level of maturity just once a distillery has been around for a while. We find they often hit the sweet spot a little over 10 years after they've opened for most places. Like before that, they may be doing really interesting and exciting things, and there are places that have made great whiskey from day one. But it takes a while to really hone in on what makes your climate unique and how you source your grain and how you choose to make whiskey in a way that turns into something really interesting and exciting.
And I think it's worth mentioning too. I agree with you. This doesn't taste like Kentucky or Tennessee, or certainly not like Texas. I think Texas has a certain, it's interesting. Sorry, this is a weird side note. I do like several Texas distilleries and Texas whiskeys, but there's an odd note that I pick up in every single one of them that is uniquely Texas. So
there's like, a Texas funk for sure. Is. Yeah.
Yeah. For me, it's like, it's the dark honey side of a Rico LaCoff drop.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, that's going to be stuff I had for the next year.
I know. Like Garrison Brother, that's the strongest in them, but I have it even in ones that I do like, ones that I don't like. But in tasting this, I'm thinking about other, you know, Wisconsin distilleries that I've either spoken to or know of, you know, Dancing Goat, Driftless Glen. And there is something definitely grain forward that comes from them. And I wonder too, Adam, as you mentioned before, this is the state that drinks the most brandy of any state by far. And I'm curious if you see, as you go through those, the any influence of the brandy creation on, or brandy production maybe, on the whiskey creation as well.
I think so in subtle ways, in terms of that is what they started out distilling first and do bring something of that brandy maker's perspective to making whiskey. When it comes to the actual like technical specifics of the distillation, I couldn't speak to that, but I know that it is something that when you are a distillery that is making both brandy and whiskey, as opposed to a distillery that is making mostly like gin and whiskey, you think about how your product is going to show differently and the choices you make differently.
Sure. There was one more question I had on this that went completely out of my mind. I will bring it back later if I remember, but, in the meantime, this really has been the first, it's not the first taste I've had of this distillery, but it's the first kind of regular release, if you will, of their own distillate. I did have a chance, I was fortunate to try their yeast trial series a couple of months ago, but those were targeting certain yeasts with certain mash bills and such. So it was a little more off the beaten path, whereas this really is an exploration and an exposure to people of what Wallerstein is producing straight out of the cask. And full blast as well. All right.
I apologize if you hear any background noise right now. We have a train going by,
But as you know, I think they came by when you were at the tasting room, but it rattles everything a little bit, but it's the fun.
All right. It just means you can't put the bottles right next to each other, right? You have to space them out just that little bit.
Yep.
Yeah. I think one of the things that we're excited about with the Midwest collection is that we're actively talking about other distilleries in the region that we like, that we didn't happen to select a cask from. And like, these are six of the distilleries in the region that we think are some of the absolute best and making some of the best whiskey, but there are other really good ones too that we didn't work with this time, either because we haven't visited in person yet or just because it didn't all come together in time. But like, there are other places across the region that exhibit the same characteristics that we like Far North Spirits in Minnesota, 45th Parallel in Wisconsin, Whiskey Acres in Illinois,
New Holland
in Michigan, Spirits of French Lick in Indiana.
Sure, there are many more that we're forgetting, right?
Yeah. It truly, we want people to start thinking about it as something of a distinct region in the same way that we do with Texas, that it has certain common features. And we think generally just a really high level of quality across the board.
We don't think people are talking about it enough, which is why we're putting our stake in the ground and saying we're doing our first regional collection, because y'all need to be paying more attention to Midwest whiskey. So
fully agree. I like promoting New York whiskey because I'm a New Yorker, but no, I agree. When I was thinking about what my next trip was going to be, I ended up, right, I'm not going on the trip because I was sick, but that's a different story. But I was going to go to Indiana because that was going to be really an exploration of what the smaller places in Indiana are doing. But just as high on my list were some of the states you're mentioning, you know, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin. I don't know if Minnesota was on there, might've been, but definitely those three. And these were places where I really wanted to visit some places I had been before and try some new ones because they're so different. And just as we move to the next one, I said to someone recently that I'd been feeling a little bit bored in bourbon, in particular American whiskey more generally, but especially in bourbon. And I don't know whether it's just because I've been fortunate to taste a lot of things or visit a lot of places, but you can only write brown sugar and caramel so many times.
Yep. Right. Fair.
And yeah, it was getting a little bored, but trying these new distilleries, these new types of production, the local grain, the local terroir, if you will, and the climate makes me excited again about these spirits. And that's, I think, the best thing that you guys are doing is just giving and injecting some excitement. Excuse me, I'm stumbling over my words. Injecting some excitement into the American whiskey space by encouraging people to look outside of, let's say, Kentucky, Tennessee, the main states that we always think of as having all the whiskey. So with that polemic out there, what would you like to taste next?
We do the House Foolery or the Starlight?
If we're going to do Starlight, we should do it next.
Okay, I think we do Starlight.
Okay.
Starlight and then Theo and then Cedar Ridge. So I think in some ways this is an interesting transition.
Yeah.
While I pour, do you want to?
Yeah. So Starlight is probably the most well-known of the distillery partners in this series. It helps that they're only about 25 minutes from Louisville, just across the river into Indiana. It's closer to Louisville than Buffalo Trace or Wild Turkey is. They are a seventh generation family business in deep, like long history of farming operations in many different ways, like a traditional farm, like pumpkin farm for pumpkin picking and blueberries and apple picking, along with the large events and convention center and all kinds of other things. And so for the last 20 years, there's also been a distillery and family owned sixth and seventh generation, and really making whiskey that we think showcases again, the Midwest and what makes Indiana slightly different from Kentucky. Even though it's just across the river, it is like a little hillier, maybe even a little cooler. Certainly every time we've been there, it's been very windy. And is but a story that when it comes to this release in particular, Starlight has made its name among whiskey lovers with doing a wide variety of finishes. They were one of the first to do an Amberana finish and toasted finishes and lots of other different and unique things, some of which are really, really good. But we also just really like their straight whiskey. So for our second single cast from Starlight, we did a six-year-old straight bourbon. No finish.
Third single cask.
Second bourbon.
Second bourbon, yeah. The interesting thing is it's actually, so we previously did a Starlight bourbon 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And we actually bought them at the same time. This one has spent 2 years in Vermont, in addition to the 4 years that it's spent in Indiana.
So with this, I have to admit, I had not had Starlight in a bit. I was more familiar with their finishes, as you mentioned, I did have one, I guess it was a double oaked rye. So it wasn't like a single, just one barrel treatment rye. And I did have a single barrel bourbon without a finish, but it has been a couple of years since that came out. I think the bourbon was the last one, that was in 2020. So it had been a bit since that came out. On this, I immediately get some notes that would be a little more familiar to, let's say, Kentucky, Northern Kentucky type, a lot of butteriness, especially melted butter, lower herbaceousness,
yeah,
a little sweeter as opposed to more savory. I would say this, so this is at 59.4% ABV. Again, drinks a little lower. If I remember, that's actually a little bit high for Starlight, right?
I think so, but they don't put stuff out that's this old generally. So the proof
fair. Will continue to go
up. So I don't think it's...
It's not crazy higher.
So that much. When we got it, it wasn't significantly higher.
So it's not them, it's you, kind of.
Yeah, pretty much. But I do think, to your point about it being more standard for us, this is us saying Midwest whiskey can also be, like, if it's from Indiana, it can be more classic in flavor, but it still has the Indiana spin on it. But it is, yes, way more classic than the Wollersheim in the few, which we're not going to taste. But those are both less kind of quote-unquote classic bourbons.
Right. You said it's 25 minutes from Louisville. It's across the river. So slightly different microclimate, yep, but not so different that, you know, you're not jumping from Kentucky to Michigan or Wisconsin or something, you know. So if you were telling people to explore this collection, because I have the benefit of, I've been fortunate to try some of these. I tried others of Lost Lantern, so I know kind of your taste profiles better. If you were telling someone to try this lineup that was not brand new to whiskey, because I probably wouldn't be at your level yet, but you know, knows enough about whiskey but is interested in trying some other ones, would you maybe start them out with the Starlight because it's more familiar?
Yeah, and I think in the order, if we're doing the full flight with someone, we taste the Far Flung Rye first because that's our flagship blend that we made, and then we do the Starlight because I do think it centers the conversation well. Like, here's a bourbon that tastes like, it's a flavor profile that you're familiar with, although slightly different from that. And then let's go to the Wisconsin, which is more grain forward, and then the Few, which is, it's another different kind of beast.
It's a good entry point for people.
Yeah, it gives good, like I said, it's familiar enough to say, okay, I recognize what this is. Mm-hmm. Then you pull them farther and farther off the road as you would.
Exactly.
And some people want to just go straight off road way on, like if we do the Cedar Ridge wheat whiskey later, that is mm-hmm. something that, like, I feel like appeals probably the most to people who either know a ton about whiskey or who are earlier in their whiskey journey and are just like, they don't know enough to be dangerous yet, where you can just like jump in and be like, oh, this is great. I don't know too much about it, but it's really good. And then if where you're like us, you can appreciate it more for being like, oh, this is a malted wheat whiskey. You know what that means. And then it's a totally different flavor profile than any of these.
Yeah.
And I think the last thing I just want to say about Starlight in particular is, and this release in particular is, because they were so known for finishes, both in the rye and the bourbon that they've done, that I really encourage people to, whenever they can, try the spirit on its own, you know, without a finish, without toasted barrels, without any of that. Just, you know, try it. To try the straight stuff. Now, I can't use that word because that's not that could get legal there. But you know, try the base spirit first.
Right.
Try the regular untouched bourbon or rye, so that when you try the finish, you can say, okay, that's where that note's coming. It's coming from the finish, not from the spirit. Or maybe it's, you know, two things coming together and elevating each other. Or are they in disharmony and they're kind of knocking each other about in not a great way? That unearthly creak was my cat entering the room. but with Starlight, I would especially encourage people to try this bottle for that same reason that you've probably tried many finishes. If you're listening to this podcast, you've definitely tried a couple of Starlight bottles in the past couple of years, but here's a chance to try it untarnished. It's 4 years in Indiana, two more in Vermont, so you're getting a higher proof than you might get otherwise, as we explored. But it's just something, there's something about trying that initial spirit that I encourage again and again and again. And then you go to the VDN finishes and the crazy brandies and chocolate and all that.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly why we did this like this. And that's also why none of the Midwest collection has any finishes, because for this is us showcasing the range of flavors that we see in the Midwest. And finishes are great. We love finishes. We regularly release whiskey with finish, but it doesn't allow the regional characteristics to come out in the same way that just a straight bourbon, straight rye, straight malted wheat whiskey can illustrate. So,
yeah. Would you, so next we're going to do the Tom's Foolery.
Yes. Right? Yep.
So while we're pouring that, would you consider in the future, because you do have both finished and unfinished, although not necessarily the same distillery, if you could get a cask of each from the same distillery, would you release those two as part of a set so people could try the base plus the finish and try to explore what those different things are? Or is that something you would more leave to the distillery itself to do?
We actually, we did that for one of our releases in summer 2022. We did two releases from Dad's Hat, Pennsylvania, side by side, one of which was a five or 6 year old straight rye. And they do a Pennsylvania style, which means no corn in the mash bill. And the other was their straight rye, 4 years old, finished in a vermouth cask. So, and when people would come up to me at a festival and I was pouring them, I would just say spicy or sweet. And it's still the same, like similar base spirit, but it just shows itself so differently with a finish. It was actually a really fun comparison.
Yeah. So we do it when the opportunity presents itself, and also when it fits the theme going forward for the release. Yeah. Yeah.
So Tom's Foolery is one that, like I said, this is the one that I had not ever heard of before, before visiting you guys. And I don't think I saw the cast. I think it was getting bottled at that point already, but you mentioned that it was coming and I was like, oh, that's a new distillery. So,
well,
I guess tell us a little bit about it.
That's my favorite thing, is when I get to introduce someone who knows a lot about whiskey and spends a lot of time thinking about whiskey to something they haven't heard of before. Cause that's really what we want. And so like, there are 2,600 distilleries now. It is really hard for even someone who knows a lot about whiskey to keep up with which ones are really exciting. So we think that that means that we're doing our job, if assuming you like it, of course. Right. But Tom's Foolery is a quite small distillery, one of the smallest that we've worked with, outside of Cleveland, in the snow belt of Ohio. So it's similar climate to Buffalo, New York, where it snows a lot and it's pretty cold. And that means that it is a much snowier and cooler climate than Kentucky is, or even than Middle West is, just a few hours south of there. And they are in some ways they remind me of the farm distilleries that you see in France, in like Normandy or Armagnac or Cognac, where farmers are basically distilling some of their own grain, some of grain from their neighbors, some grain from farther afield, but just showcasing that unique climate. Small place and one of the first to start in that region. They've been going since 2008. And that also means that they have some of the oldest whiskey that we've ever seen from a newer distillery. This is a 9-year-old single cask. And
they were actually the first non kind of Kentucky, Tennessee, whatever distillery to release a bottle and bond
since Prohibition.
Yeah. So they've been around for a while. Yeah. And for me, the fun of this is the 9-year age statement means something wildly different when you're in a cool climate, because right. Maturation is really, I'm simplifying this, obviously. There are two main ways that a whiskey matures. It's through barrel interaction and the extraction, and the interaction with oxygen and the oxygenation, the oxidizing, for want of a better word. It's not really oxidizing, but it's that interaction with the oxygen that happens over many, many years. And in cooler climates, unlike in hot climates where that extraction process takes the wheel, in cooler climates, that oxygen interaction takes over. And so it's a different version of mature. And that's fascinating to us with cooler climate, because you get to taste that in a way that you don't in a warmer climate where you're just getting the barrel at 9 years.
See, that's going to be one. They're definitely on my list now, but this is going to be for the herb lovers. It has enough sweetness to it where it's balanced for sure, but the nose just perfumes with dill, tarragon, a little thyme in there. I love it. I'm kind of a high rye guy. I don't really like the barely legal ryes. If I want a rye, I want a rye, you know. But you're right though. I was thinking about this because Adam, I think you said this earlier, that for you, these kind of sweet spots happen at 10 years plus for places. And I meant to catch on that when you first said it, that you're not saying, and I know you're not saying this, that that's not when the whiskey hits 10 years old. It means when they've been doing it for 10 years plus. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it could be they've been in existence 10 years and have a 3-year-old whiskey. That's fantastic. It's because it took that long to get it right for their region, for their place. In the case of this, where they started in 2008, you've got a 9-year-old product already. That means they figured it out relatively quickly and probably without a lot of help, because they would have been starting in the early days of the craft boom. It's really impressive. And yes, as Nora, as you mentioned, this is not at all oaky. Like, I could barely taste any oak or wood in this other than hints of vanilla in the background and what you would normally get from an American oak barrel. Yeah. It's just not woody. And I like that a lot because I hate chewing on oak stave. It's like my least favorite thing in whiskey. I'll take the Laphroaig over the chewing on the oak stave, to be honest.
Fair enough. I think the other thing that's really unique about this whiskey is the mash bill. It's 70% unmalted rye and 30% malted rye. So 100% rye all in, but an interesting version of 100% rye.
Any Irish heritage in Tom's Foolery? I don't know why you would know that off the top of my head, but
yeah.
Whenever I hear like 100% grain bill, but split between mashed and unmashed, malted and unmalted, I always immediately think single pot still. So,
yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, that could, it's a connection that rarely actually hits, but it was just something that came to mind.
Yeah.
So you're
speaking of strange connections. We discovered when we went there, and we're chatting with, the owner, or the co-owners, Tom and Leanne Herbrook, somehow it came up that I went to the same college that they did, 15 years apart, but they went to Hamilton College in Western New York. I went to Hamilton College in Western New York, and it's just,
and there's some serious Hamilton pride. So then I basically was not a part of the conversation after that was discovered, but I'm used to it. So yeah, small world.
I got my own Hamilton connection. I was not, Nora, I'm with you. I was not an attendee there, but one of my kind of oldest friends and someone who I got into whiskey now in the last few years left where I was at Binghamton. He went up to Hamilton to work. So he worked there for several years before finally moving down to Maryland. So it's a tangential connection, I know, but it's like, I mean, Adam, you know, how often do you come across a Hamilton kind of connection like that? So it's weird when it comes up.
Exactly.
You got to talk about it. So when you were trying this distillery, had you, tried them before? You know, what was the distance between when you first tried them and when you said, okay, we're going to do something with you guys?
We knew about them because they were one of the first bottled in bond whiskeys from newer distilleries on the market, and made a bit of a splash with that at the time, like even like Chuck Cowdery and some of the more like Kentucky focused bourbon folks were writing about them. So we'd encountered it, but it was never a place that was particularly trying to be super big. Like, this is the opposite of a Wilderness Trail, where they're suddenly, like, over the course of 10 years, they go from being really tiny to being huge. And this is like, they're small, they're staying small. So it was, once we visited, they've always been on our short list, and it was just a matter of time until we could get them to give up a few barrels, because they don't really make that many. So we really had to like convince them, like, hey, we really want to showcase you and get people excited about you who don't know what you're doing, even though that means you'll have one last 9-year-old barrel for yourselves.
And as it's opening up a little bit of air, there's apricot. It's really jumping out at me in the palate. Like a very specific apricot jelly.
I like that. You know,
We're coming up on both Purim and Easter. And so I'm thinking of like the Hamantash with the apricot filling in there. That's what's popping out to me. When you were trying the barrels, did you, understanding that they don't have a huge stock of barrels, age 9 years, even less so, were there any barrels earlier, like at a younger age, let's say, that you were thinking about, or do you feel like the 9 years was really their sweet spot?
I think that we tasted a decent number ranging from 7 to 11 years old or so, maybe one that was 12. And for us, this was roughly the sweet spot. And
old enough to, because it was so cold, it takes a while for it to age, but also I think the 11, like, they had figured something out in their distillation process in that time frame between like the 11 years and the 9 years, where you saw them both dialed in from a climate perspective, but also from their whiskey making perspective, they had really dialed it in at that, in that sweet spot.
And that's a very common trend we've seen with basically any distillery that is younger than like 25 or 30 years old, or like younger than like the very established places. the oldest whiskey they have is never, to our perspective, the best. It is usually something they have that came like after they did a full turn on their whiskey. They distilled it, waited till whatever got to whatever age they wanted to, released it, distilled something else after learning from that is usually interesting. So we often ask distilleries, like, we don't want to taste your oldest stuff. We want special barrels, but not, we don't care about age. We want things that really showcase your vision. And that is, for us, this was the sweet spot for them.
It's worth noting it. We've alluded to it a few times, but for all the transparency that is on your bottles, from even, you know, even the samples that I received, but the full size bottles as well, the age statement is not the most prominent thing on there. If it's on there, there are a couple that I've seen that did not have a specific age statement on there. You can find out that information from the website, from press releases and such. But to your point, the age is not the most important thing. It's about how does it taste?
Right. Instead. If the age is always on the back, it's not the biggest thing, but we like to say we're age agnostic. We go for flavor, and that, and the maturity age depends on so many things, including climate, including production methods. And so it's really about finding that distillery's sweet spot and working with that.
Yeah, like age should be a part of the conversation, but by no means all of it, which I think is something that the Scotch world has gotten themselves into over the last 20 or 30 years. And now everyone's like, well, it's not 18 years old, so this is stupid. So we don't want to focus on that part of the conversation, but like Nora said, it is always on the label. Sometimes we put it on the front label if it's particularly notable for some reason. We should start putting the age statement on the front for the really young ones too. Like we've done some Arizona whiskey that's has a 1 year age statement. We should put that on the front label.
Like putting stuff on there that's going to scare people away. We want people to have the experience of the whiskey without preconceived notions. We want them to be explorers in some ways. Like part of what we're offering is that chance to taste things that they wouldn't taste otherwise. And I really like when people are surprised by something. Everyone has an expectation going into it. We don't want someone to be like, oh, it's going to be 1 year old. I'm going to hate this. And then they go in and it's much harder to change their mind. Hopefully we would change their mind anyway, but it's a steeper hill to climb. Certainly.
That's fair. I definitely hear both sides on that one. And I'm thinking the 1 year from Arizona Whiskey Del Bac.
Yeah.
Yeah. Always. So, also, but not, I think I actually got connected with them because of our initial interview. So they were great today, but they're a great example because their whiskey is ready at 1 to 2 years old.
Yeah.
Whereas, I mean, any of the ones that we're tasting today, they may be great today at 1 year. They probably almost surely were not ready. It's right. Different climates, totally different climates. Yeah, so I like that term, age agnostic. Maybe I'll adopt that too. Before we go to the last pour, the Cedar Ridge, I wanted to pick up on, Adam, what you said on the Scotch too. Well, what you both said about the Scotch world too, is it's another opportunity for us, I don't know, whiskey files, people who really enjoy exploring whiskey and trying new things, that so many people are focused on not just the 12 year age statements anymore, but the 15, the 18, going to the 20s. And some of them are great at that age. Look, I love Macallan 18. It's my favorite expression. I'll never afford one again, but it's my favorite expression from them. But at the same time, that means that there are distilleries like Lochlea, that are relatively brand new in comparison, that at 3 years old, they've got some spirit. They had to wait 3 years because of the Scotch Whiskey Association regulations, but 3 years in a day, they can put out a whiskey that's really interesting. Or Waterford in Ireland doing the same thing at younger age statements, where you can still, almost in a way, what you're trying to do with the Midwest, like showing the grain and letting the grain express itself. I would argue actually that you guys are, and the distilleries in the Midwest that you're focusing on are letting the grain showcase even more, just because there's no, in this collection, there's no fancy casking. It's, you know, no, as you said earlier, no finishes in this one. So really showcasing the grain. I don't know. I want people to be more age agnostic. I want them to think like us. At the same time, I'm like, that means that there's that many bottles that are available for those of us who know that you can have a good scotch at 3 to 6 years old. You don't have to wait to 15 or till it goes to college in order for it to be a good scotch. Anyway, that's my second rant. I should really stop myself. So in order to stop myself, shall we hit Cedar Ridge?
Yes.
Let's do it.
Let's hit Cedar Ridge. So Cedar Ridge is a core partner of ours.
Yeah. So we've worked with them. I think they're in a, they alternate with Balcones for the distillery that we've worked with the most at any given time. May I have some tea? And they are in the heart of Iowa. One of the older distilleries that we've worked with, they've been around for getting close to 20 years now. And are, as you know from having talked to them, are also the top selling bourbon in Iowa. But we think that just about everything they make is really interesting. We've done a bourbon, a rye, a single malt, and now a wheat whiskey from them. And we've included them in two of our multi-distillery blends as well.
Including Farflung Rye, yeah. Which is part of this collection.
Yeah.
Right.
So this is our first wheat whiskey from them, the second wheat whiskey that we've ever done. 100% malted white winter wheat, which is a mouthful, especially after five whiskeys, and 6 years old.
It's also a slightly more unusual grain. Usually hear red winter wheat, whether soft or hard, not so much the white winter wheat. It's funny. The first note I get off this is almost brandy-esque.
Interesting. I could see that.
You know, dryness, but a lot of fruitiness or dried fruit in there. A little bit of kind of trail mix cerealness in there. But I guess if you put trail mix and some dried fruit in there, that would hit pretty nicely now that I think about it. So the malting of the wheat adds so much more complexity, in my opinion.
Same. Absolutely. Yeah. The only wheat whiskeys we've done are malted wheat for that reason. It provides structure. It provides complexity. It makes it a really interesting whiskey. Mm-hmm. Wheat can often just be gentle. Full stop.
Yeah.
Not all of them, but like that is, can be what they're like. But I think the malting of the wheat makes that possible. It goes well beyond that.
Yeah. No, I agree. I usually get with a straight wheat whiskey. Let's call it 100% wheat whiskeys. They can be very good, but it's usually fairly one note, like vanilla and caramel, almost like the cask and the liquid have become one in some ways, which it, like I said, it can be good. It can be very, there are some that I really enjoy, but not as complex. That's, you use that word, Nora, and I think that's the right word to use, that the malting just allows different compounds to form and different flavors to develop. And I'm sure it's not easy. I know it's an extra step. It's an extra cost. It's extra time for the distillery to do it. But if you're looking to stand out, it makes a big difference.
Yeah.
And I can't remember who said this, but the fun also of this is they really only release their wheat whiskey in the tasting room. So it's quite infrequent that people can get their hands on it. So we were excited when we were able to snap.
Certainly,
it.
Yeah.
So,
Yeah.
Cedar. So you mentioned Cedar Ridge is one of your core partners. Mm-hmm. And, you know, having done a number of casts with them, having included them in multiple multi-distillery blends, when you have worked with a brand and a distillery that much, when you go back and you say, okay, we want a new barrel, we want to find something else, have you found that you're looking for something totally new? Or because I would imagine you've now been doing this for, this is in your fifth year now, officially, let's call it your fifth year. And you have a couple of stories, as you said, Balcones being another one where you've worked with them enough to really get a sense of their range. So I guess what I'm asking is then, what do you look for that excites you and keeps you going back to a distillery?
I think there are two different answers to that question. One that thinks more about blends and one that is focused more on single cask. So from a blend perspective, we love Cedar Ridge because their whiskey plays really nicely with others. It is something that enhances, doesn't like duke it out with the other flavors. Some whiskey doesn't want to hang out. But Cedar Ridge is like the mellow friend that will go on whatever road trip you want to go on. And so that's great. And we can build blends knowing, I mean, obviously after they tell us they can sell us the whiskey, but knowing that we can use that as the glue for some of our blends. So some of what we're looking for is knowing exactly what we want for the blends and buying from that. But from single cast, it is very often trying to showcase a side of the distillery that people don't usually get to see or haven't even seen from us. So that applies here. That applies for Gentle Giant with Balcones, showing something that we've seen in the warehouses or rickhouses or whatever they call it at that distillery and bringing that forward and saying, we want everyone to know about this cool thing that they're doing that they wouldn't know about otherwise.
Yeah. And at the same time, we always have to remember that even if it's a distillery that we really love and we know really well and want to show off their funky side, there are a lot of people, even among whiskey lovers, who will never have heard of them or never have tried it before. So we may get some like cool single cask with a unique finish in some weird style of whiskey, but often I'll also be like, hey, can we talk about a barrel of bourbon or a barrel of single malt too? Because we want to still go out there and tell the story to people who just haven't had a chance to experience it at all yet. And we just need to know their core style.
Especially as we're starting to sell in bars and stores in local markets where people, it's new people that won't have tasted a previous product of ours generally. Mm-hmm. So there is a need to reintroduce these distilleries to that new customer.
I mean, I keep going back to this one. I love Cedar Ridge. I love what they're doing. And this one in particular, again, we're talking 61.6%. So, I mean, none of these were, softballs, let's say, but I think either drinks at proof softly or drinks a little bit below and with a nice pop to it. And maybe that's also because the wheat whiskey, you can handle a little bit more spice because there's not a spice from, let's say, the rye or even some of the bourbon esters that can come off, but it's really delicious. I keep going back to these, and I know we're not going to taste the Middle West and the Few Spirits ones on air, but those will be included in notes and in final either article or a series of interviews. I haven't quite decided yet, but I will make sure to get those notes out there. As you're just to kind of round out as we're going, one question that keeps coming to me, and Nora, you just brought it back, was you're now expanding. You know, you're doing more barrels, more blends, more distilleries, visiting, Adam, as you were saying, visiting, you said 29 this year already, you know, more maybe?
No, but in like five or six states.
Yeah.
I don't know where the number 29 came from. That must have been earlier that it got lodged in my head. Sorry. But, you visited so many distilleries just this year already, and you're looking forward. You also now have a physical space that you didn't have before in Vermont. And I really encourage people to go and visit, make sure they're open before you go visit, but visit on the days when they're open to taste everything they've got right now, which there are a couple here that I wanted to shout out that are not part of this collection, which is the focus of this episode, but I still wanted to point out as whiskeys to look at. The Mountain Meadow, which has been mentioned a couple of times, is, I think, still the most interesting whiskey that I've tried this year. It's, from St. George. It's just so different. I know there'll be people who taste it and hate it. There'll be people who taste it and love it. But I don't think you're going to come away from it thinking, oh, that was just another whiskey that I've tried. Right. So, that one has stuck with me. The Brooklyn Bakery has been such a great blend of a single distillery. I'm a big Kings County fan. You said bottles are running low, so I would definitely make a run on those. And I wanted to just point those out before moving forward. But I guess as a rounding question, as you're expanding, as you're getting into bars and more retailers and more markets, how has your target audience evolved? If it has evolved.
I think the target audience hasn't really evolved, but I think the difference is we were only selling to people that were willing to buy bottles online. And that's a really, really small subset of whiskey buyers. Even the really highly educated whiskey drinkers that want to explore, a lot of people have the bottle shop with the buyer that they know, or a specific salesperson that they go to and say, what should I try next? Or they want to try it at a bar first and then they'll buy a bottle. We're just starting to crack that part of the market. I think the people we're selling to are still really excited about learning about whiskey and expanding horizons, tasting new things, being someone that's on the cusp of the exciting things that are happening in the US. It just happened. We're accessing more of those people now.
Yeah, I think that's right. And the still the best way to get our stuff in most of the country is just go to our website and we'll tell you where to buy it from, whether that's through the retailer that powers our site or through Sealbox. But even
in a state like New York, we are, as of next week, we're going to show where things are available in person as well. So the retailers that have things, if you want to buy local, if you want to support a local store, you'll be able to go to our website and
sold out online launch day, but some stores still have it.
Yeah, exactly. So that if you're in a state where we sell to stores, that will also be more visible so that you can really track down whatever bottle you want if it's still out there in the world.
Fantastic. I mean, I still owe myself a bottle of the Mountain Meadow. I will pick it up at some point. I've got a couple of costs coming up that might delay that. I'll tell you off air, but like I said, I just keep thinking about that bottle. I really do. So with that, I want to say, you know, we focus today on the spring 2024 Midwest collection. Can you preview for us? Are you allowed to preview for us what the next collection is going to look like? And you can say no.
I think we can say it's not regional. It will be focused on one style of whiskey, but that's all we'll say. So highly themed this year, but changing the general thrust of the theme for summer.
And we'll have a bunch of new distillery partners and from new states, which will be fun.
Fantastic. Well, again, this should be a quick turnaround for this episode. I hope to get this out on or before the date when these all go live. You'll have the Far Flung Rye in-house blend. You'll have single barrels from Wollersheim, Starlight, Tom's Foolery, Cedar Ridge, Middle West, and Few Spirits, all available, plus the many bottles and single barrels and blends that are available still at Lost Lantern. Lost Lantern Whiskey or LostLantern.com. I should have looked that up. I'm sorry.
LostLanternWhiskey.com.
Thank you. LostLanternWhiskey.com. There'll also be a link to that in the show notes. Again, I can't speak highly enough of Lost Lantern and what you guys are doing. Tell everyone whenever I get a chance. So you're always welcome back when you've got a new expression, whether it's one, whether it's 10. I love talking to you both and having you on. So thank you for coming back and talking about your new releases.
Likewise. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Enjoyed this.
A lot of fun.
Awesome. Well, if you enjoyed listening, thank you so much. Listen to the end roll for a little more information on the show and watch for my notes on all these whiskeys. And I think you'll enjoy them. Adam Nora, hang on with me for just a second after recording. It's been another episode of the Whiskey Ring Podcast, and I'll see you all next week.
Hey, folks. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Whiskey Ring Podcast. If you like what you hear, please go ahead and click that subscribe, follow, or like button. Leave a rating review on your podcast app of choice. And let me know what you want to hear. You can reach out to me through the podcast apps or email me at david@whiskeymyweddingring.com with any suggestions or ideas for new show guests. You can also support the podcast at patreon.com/whiskeyinmyweddingring. That's whiskey with an E for as little as $1 a month. $5 a month gets you access to bonus content, including our soon to resume Under the Influencer series. And $25 a month means you join the Barrel Share Club. Each month, Barrel Share Club members get to try products sent to me for review, bottles from my own collection, and sometimes bottles that I just pick up because they're fun or interesting. Right now, only 5 spots remain in the Barrel Share Club, so grab your place today. Finally, please follow on Instagram. You can follow me at Whiskey My Wedding Ring or at Whiskey Ring Podcast. You can follow me on Twitter at Whiskey Ring. You can follow on Facebook at Whiskey My Wedding Ring or join the Facebook group, the Whiskey Ringers group. And I hope to see you there. Cheers, thank you for the support, and see you next time.